think this is kind of a vestigial organ here. We don't have sound on, as far as I know. So if you have any problems hearing me, just raise your hand, let me know. I hear that Father Michael mistakenly said Father Mark me to stare. I want to just clear the air and just reiterate that I'm not ordained, I'm not a priest, though my younger brother is a priest, and there's kind of a tradition of this with my family here. Shortly after I got married in 2000, my younger brother, Father Pacomius Mead, he's a Benedictine monk at the Abbey, Conception Abbey in northwest Missouri. He was here to come celebrate Mass, and Father Bill had said, we're here to welcome, we also want to welcome Father Pacomius Mead, who was here in town for his to celebrate his brother's funeral. my wife's cousin Courtney, who's altar server here, was furiously nudging Father Bill. Wedding, Father, wedding. So this is a tradition, an ongoing tradition. Hopefully, we'll just keep this tradition going here. And I speak a lot of places on Thomas Merton, but it's nice to be home. Nice to be here at my home parish, speaking to people who have a wide variety of knowledge on Thomas Merton. So. First off, I just want to mention that this is not going to be Merton 101. I don't have time to do a really full-fledged introduction to Thomas Merton. So I'll just mention a few bare bones to those of you who just may not know Thomas Merton or just need kind of a reminder, a little bit of some of the markers of his life. Merton was born in 1915, died in 1968, in somewhat of a freak accident. He was a Trappist monk who wrote his autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, published in 1948, which really put him on the map as a writer. Was well known after that, and then continued to write books with a spiritual theme, but also poetry, social criticism, a white American challenging us on race, challenging us to support civil rights in this country. A pioneer of interfaith dialogue. But through all those various interests of Merton, and I think for a lot of people it can be very overwhelming that he wrote about so many different kinds of issues and was interested in so many different things, there's a real lens, a real focus to all his writing. It's that lens of the contemplative experience, being a contemplative monk. That informed everything that he wrote about and gave a unique voice when he's writing about civil rights in the United States, that there is this moral center from which we're coming to this issue as well. And that's what we're going to focus on today, that contemplative lens, that contemplative side of Merton's writing. And I wanted to put a special emphasis on Lent, now that we're in the Lenten season. The book that I'm going to focus on, Contemplative Prayer, is not written specifically about Lent, but I think it lends itself very well to our Lenten reading. Okay, thank you.
It'll get control the lights there.
Brighter, and I don't know, someone can shut off the lights in the back, just in the back. We also may come to this issue with some preconceived baggage, some notions, as we come to Lenten prayer, Lenten prayer of the desert. We think of this dry, arid landscape. Oh, this is going to be a rough presentation, Mark. You're going to take us into this desolate territory. Hopefully the presentation on this won't be dry. You hear that, you hear, oh, this is going to be about monasticism and Lent, so maybe a lot of self-flagellation, just mortifications of the flesh, just sour and dour the whole time. Merton challenges us in some of those assumptions that we bring to the Lenten season. He wrote a beautiful essay called Ash Wednesday, in which he says, "Even the darkest moments of the liturgy are filled with joy. And Ash Wednesday, the beginning of the Lenten fast, is a day of happiness, a Christian feast. It cannot be otherwise." as it forms part of the great Easter cycle. We must remember the original meaning of Lent as the Ver Sacrum, the Church's holy spring in which the catechumens were prepared for their baptism and public penitents were made ready by penance for the restoration to the sacramental life and communion with the rest of the Church. Lent is then not a season of punishment so much as one of healing. The cross of ashes traced upon the forehead of each Christian is not only a reminder of death, but inevitably, though tacitly, a pledge of resurrection. So if anybody came today thinking of Monty Python, the Holy Grail, and the monks, you know, chanting and hitting boards on their head, Pie Jesu Domine, smack, dona eis requiem. Hear the air there. We're bringing in some joy to the Lenten season, seeing the full arc of things. The liturgy of Ash Wednesday is not focused on the sinfulness of the penitent, but on the mercy of God, Merton says. There is joy in the salutary fasting and abstinence of the Christian who eats and drinks less in order that his mind may be more clear and receptive, receive the sacred nourishment of God's word, which the whole Church announces and meditates upon in each day's liturgy throughout Lent. The whole life and teaching of Christ pass before us, and Lent is a season of special reflection and prayer, a 40-day retreat in which each Christian, to the extent that one is able, tries to follow Christ into the desert by prayer and fasting. So we're going to get to the desert. Hopefully we won't leave you there, or at least, you know, God will intervene in this process. I base much of this presentation on a book that's most commonly found on shelves as Contemplative Prayer, but it's been published under two separate titles, the same book, The Climate of Monastic Prayer and Contemplative Prayer. Both are descriptive of what the book is about. They talk about different aspects of it. But there was a concern that lay people would not think the book was necessarily for them, as published as The Climate of Monastic Prayer. And throughout Merton's career as a writer, he encouraged lay people to experience the contemplative life as much as they were able. And in many ways, he anticipated some of the documents that came out of the Second Vatican Council, not just on this issue, but on other issues. But on this issue in particular, the universal call to holiness that was proclaimed in Lumen Gentium. In Contemplative Prayer, Merton argues, a practical, non-academic study of monastic prayer should be of interest to all Christians, since every Christian is bound to be, in some sense, a person of prayer. Now, Merton also argued that there should be a specialized vocation for contemplative monks and nuns. He thinks there was a place in our busy world for people who really made this their life's work and could be exemplars to bring people in. Gethsemane is such an important place for people to come and get away from the world, get away from our busy routines. And he thought that should remain. And even during the Second Vatican Council, I think there was a lot of anxiety among contemplative orders that we need to give away, this isn't relevant anymore to modern life. But in some ways, it's more relevant than ever, just because we're more busy, we're more distracted than ever. But certainly, he thought lay people should also be more involved in contemplative life. But if God is calling lay people to participate in the contemplative life, how does Merton explain contemplation's meaning? What is contemplation according to Thomas Merton? In New Seeds of Contemplation, he describes it thusly. Contemplation, by which we know and love God as he is in himself, apprehending him in a deep and vital experience, which is beyond the reach of any natural understanding, is the reason for our creation by God. So whatever we may be doing in our lives to try to be good Christians, to be in a state of grace, to avoid sin, this is just all the preparation, the preparatory stages. We're really seeking union with God. One of the, some others have described contemplation as a mystical encounter with God that goes beyond human concepts and capacity to put it into words. Because of this, we ought to be suspect of people who want to present us a program, a bulleted list, 1, 2, 3, do this, do that, do this, and suddenly you'll be entering into contemplative prayer. Merton is skeptical of this. I think any readers in contemplation should be skeptical of programs, roadmaps. Merton's description, his climate of prayer, really brings us to the threshold of contemplation, puts us in that desert milieu, but it doesn't tell us how to get there. God has to do that, and it has to come through a surrendering on our part. The desert can be a means of disposing ourselves to contemplative prayer by attending to silence and dispelling illusions and distractions of our daily lives that we use to divert our attention from larger concerns. Our mortality, problem of evil in the world, the existence of God, these big issues. Just as Christ was tempted in the desert, we face these existential dilemmas and we're tempted to flee to the comfort of distraction. Cell phone, I'm as guilty as a lot of people, you know, our devices that we have in the world. But it doesn't have to be high tech. It could be, you know, a fluffy book or a fluffy movie. Not that those things aren't good at times, but if it leads us to distraction, if we never get deeper, if we never deepen our prayer life with God, then it is a problem. Rather than offer us simple solutions, guideposts, landmarks to supposedly get us through this desert, Merton would say this is an illusion. We can dispose ourselves to prayer, but there are no roadmaps through this desert. We have to proceed humbly by the light of faith. Merton continues about this climate of prayer. The climate in which monastic prayer flowers is that of the desert, where comfort is absent, where the secure routines of the city offer no support, where prayer must be sustained by God in the purity of faith. The liturgy, which is the monk's joy, and which reveals to him the glory of God, cannot fill a heart that has previously been humbled and emptied by dread. Alleluia is the song of the desert. So here you go. You're going to complain to me that I promised joy in what Merton was writing, and here he's bringing in this concept of dread. This kind of existential feeling of, you know, things that you fear, that's something concrete. You know, I have a fear of heights, but dread is something bigger about those big issues of life, and an uneasy feeling about it. And in fact, this is a term that was used by a lot of 20th century existentialist writers, and Merton was reading a lot of these 20th century existentialists, and he had a lot of parallel thoughts with them. He had a lot of sympathy for the writer Albert Camus, and thought he had a lot to say about our inauthenticity. A lot of times Merton says the true self versus the false self. We present a false self to the world, to society. Camus talked a lot about being inauthentic. But Merton comes from a little bit different, from a different perspective as a theist. He would say part of this inauthenticity is that our individual ego forgets our contingency upon God, our dependence upon God. You know, we forget where we're from, who created us, and that causes us problems. In Merton's words, when we seem to possess and use our being and natural faculties in a completely autonomous manner, as if our individual ego were the pure source and end of our own acts, then we are an illusion, and our acts, however spontaneous they may seem to be, lack spiritual meaning and authenticity. Consequently, first of all, our meditation should begin with the realization of our nothingness and helplessness in the presence of God. This need not be a mournful or discouraging experience. On the contrary, it can be deeply tranquil and joyful, since it brings us into direct contact with the source of all joy and all life. Source of all joy and all life. So, I've kind of brought us around a little bit back to that sense of joy, hopefully. This photograph is also titled by Merton, kind of the humorous caption, "The Only Known Photograph of God." Speaking more on contemplative prayer, I don't want to go back too much to Monty Python, but, you know, we can do Blessed Are the Cheesemakers here. Unfortunately, Gethsemane does not make cheese anymore. I was really sad about that. They're still making the fruitcakes, but not the cheese. Contemplative prayer is, in a way, simply the preference for the desert, for emptiness, for poverty. As an aside, you may think of the preferential option for the poor. It's been lifted up for us, and this can be, you know, something that comes out of our prayer. If our prayer starts in simpleness and poverty, it can blossom out into a concern for the social needs of our brothers and sisters around us. And it can start in the social sphere and come back into our prayer life. Burton continues, "One has begun to know the meaning of contemplation when one intuitively and spontaneously seeks the dark and unknown path of aridity in preference to every other way. Only when we're able to let go of everything within us, all desire to see, to know, to taste, and experience the presence of God, do we truly become able to experience that presence with the overwhelming conviction and reality that revolutionizes our entire inner life." That letting go, though, is difficult. There are a lot of obstacles that we have, especially in the West, American culture, maybe especially. And I would like to lift up a couple challenges that Merton presents us for us to unlearn typical ways of operating in Western civilization that hold us back from really being good contemplatives. I'm going to note two bad habits in particular. The first is an especially central tenet of the American ethic, which we find counterproductive in contemplative life. It's that by application of effort, just by praying myself up by my bootstraps, I can just bring myself into the presence of God. If I just worked a little bit harder. It has so much more to do, Merton says, with an act of surrendering, of vulnerability to allowing God to come to us. We don't like this. We want to be the ones in control. So we endeavor to deepen our love of God, but it's not a romantic conquest. We can't possess God. We have to be humbly open to God's presence, but not ambitious to try to have God. The second bad habit in the contemplative life stems from the Cartesian split. Now, I know I'm delving back into your memory banks, Philosophy 101. What was the most famous quote from René Descartes? "I think, therefore I am." So the Cartesian split, Cartesian from Descartes, it's the object-subject split, and the split between the mind and the body. The mind as this detached, rational observer. We dissect, we put things under the microscope, and we study all the fragmented little bits. Now, this is fine. This has contributed immensely in the West, especially to science, the development of technology. Merton doesn't dispute this. Merton sees the value in that, in science. But when we lose a unitive vision of things, we lose that sense of contingency that we have upon God, our dependence on God, as I mentioned. We detach ourselves from God and God's creation. We more easily exploit the planet and its people, forgetting our common source in God and our common home, the planet. If you want to invite a match of fisticuffs with Thomas Merton, a Trappist monk devoted to a life of nonviolence, overuse a term like mental prayer. Merton himself even used it a few times, but he really had a discomfort with the term mental prayer. For Merton, this exemplified the Cartesian split between the mind and the heart. And discursive methods of prayer, using the mind to enter into prayer, are fine as long as we don't lose the sense that the heart has to come into it. We always pray with the heart, according to Thomas Merton. You know, one of those more discursive methods was mentioned by Father Michael last month in his discussion of Ignatian prayer, that you can open up a gospel and try to place yourself somewhere in the setting of that gospel. And that's a good thing to do, and that certainly involves the mind. But it also involves the emotions, the heart. And I think Merton and St. Ignatius would agree that the heart needs to be involved in that kind of process. So prayer is never just a head trip. Prayer has to involve the heart. That's a bit of a longer quote, but I think it brings together some of these concepts I mentioned, a rebuttal of some of these Western pitfalls. God is invisibly present to the ground of our being, Merton says. Our belief and love attain to him, but he remains hidden from the arrogant gaze of our investigating mind, which seeks to capture him and secure permanent possession of him in an act of knowledge that can give power over him. It is in fact absurd and impossible to try to grasp God as an object which can be seized and comprehended by our minds. The knowledge of which we are capable is simply knowledge about God. It points to him in analogies which we must transcend in order to reach him. But we must transcend ourselves as well as our analogies. And in seeking to know him, we must forget the familiar subject-object relationship which characterizes our ordinary acts of knowing. Instead, we know God insofar as we become aware of ourselves as known through and through by God. We possess him in proportion as we realize ourselves to be possessed by him in the inmost depth of our being. Meditation or prayer of the heart is the active effort we make to keep our hearts open so that we may be enlightened by him and filled with this realization of our true relation to God. So what are we hoping to do in this process of Lent? We are hoping for some kind of crossing over. Pascha means crossover. And that's where we get this term Paschal mystery. We're united with the suffering and death of Christ in order to experience resurrection. We remember the comforts of Egypt, you know, if you think of the Exodus story. You know, the people were in slavery, but at the same time, there was a square meal every day. And when we're in the desert, when we're in the midst of our Lenten fast, we forget this, and we want to go back to our distractions. We want to go back to the comforts of not thinking about these big life issues. We don't want to be alone with God, because then our own demons come to tempt us. So in the desert, we have to abandon ourselves to the mercy of God. It's not always the most pleasant experience. You can go through that dark night of the soul. St. John of the Cross talks so much about. But we're sustained through liturgical prayer. We're sustained by the Psalms. Through silence, meditation, humility, we can strip away these illusions which put barriers between ourselves and God. And hopefully we'll cross over to the promised land. And for Merton, that is that contemplative awareness, that promised land. He quotes John Chrysostom. He puts it quite succinctly. It's not enough to leave Egypt. One must also enter the promised land. And so that's what we're seeking to do through contemplative prayer. But if you're tempted to think that this whole process is a me and God kind of thing, Merton wants to dispel these illusions as well. Beyond the inadequacy of this term, mental prayer, it's even problematic to make a firm distinction between private prayer and public or liturgical prayer, because no prayer is really private. We're entering in to something, a mystery that's much bigger than the isolated ego to God, but it also has to involve our neighbor as well. Merton puts it this way: in reality, the monk abandons the world in order to listen more intently to the deepest and most neglected voices that proceed from its inner depths. Meditation has no point and no reality unless it's firmly rooted in life. In the preface Merton wrote to the Japanese edition of the Seven Story Mountain in 1963, he goes on to say this other point, which could maybe be summed up in the term monastic protest. Here, Merton had hosted a retreat for peacemakers at Gethsemane in 1962. He challenges them from the perspective of a contemplative. You know, by what right do you enter into protest? So it wasn't just a rah-rah kind of moment. He was pushing back from his perspective as a contemplative, as someone who thought very deeply about social movements, social issues, but as somebody who was also supportive of a number of things of these things that were going on. He says, it's my intention to make my entire life a rejection of, a protest against the crimes and injustices of war and of political tyranny which threaten to destroy the whole human race and the world with us. By my monastic life and vows, I am saying no to all the concentration camps, the aerial bombardments, the staged political trials, the judicial murders, the racial injustices, the economic tyrannies, and the whole socio-economic apparatus which seems geared for nothing but global destruction, in spite of all its fair words in favor of peace. But it is true, nevertheless, that the faith which I believe is also invoked by many who believe in war, believe in racial injustices, believe in self-righteous and lying forms of tyranny. My life, then, must be a protest against these also, and perhaps against these most of all. And if I say no to these secular forces, I also say yes to all that is good in the world and in humanity. I say yes to all that is beautiful in nature. And in order that my yes may be a yes of freedom and not a subjection, I must refuse to possess anything in the world purely as my own. I say yes to all these men and women who are my brothers and sisters in the world. But for this yes to be an assent of freedom and not of subjection, I must live so that no one of them may seem to belong to me and that I may not belong to any one of them. It is because I want to be more to them than a friend that I become to all of them a stranger. I think this paradox is on its face difficult to understand. One of the best analogies was given to me by the Baptist professor Glenn Hinson, and he knew Thomas Merton well. He brought groups of the students from the seminary here down to have dialogue with Thomas Merton. And the way that he put it, you know, this was a time when Merton was taking more time for silence and solitude. He was living as a hermit on the property of the Abbey of Gethsemane, yet he was engaging more and more in some of these social movements. And he said the further that Merton put his pipeline out into the world, the deeper he needed to drill as well. And I think that metaphor really holds up. The further he put his pipeline into the world, the deeper he needed to drill his well. So I want to sum up a few things that maybe we can practice, and maybe this print on this slide is a little too small to really see really well, but I'll try to sum it up. To help us produce this climate of prayer in which Merton says we can dispose ourselves to the mercy of God. Not always pleasant, but we will find joy in the end if we trust God. We can fast from things that keep us from being free, from those things that separate us from God, those things that distract us from God, and even from the systems which exploit our neighbors locally and globally. This enables us to speak against exploitation without ourselves being those hypocrites that talked about. People that espouse the faith that you and I do, but also believe in war, are not helping the least among us. We can infuse our work with prayer. Now, for monks, many of whom have manual labor as an essential part of their day, it's a little bit easier if you're doing some kind of mindless work. So it may not be your vocation where you're going to do this. Maybe it's your avocation. Maybe it's a hobby. Maybe you do knitting. Maybe you do gardening. But in these kind of settings as well, you can infuse those activities with prayer. Throughout the centuries, the gospel image of Mary and Martha has been lifted up as the exemplar model of contemplation and action. St. Bernard uses this great analogy that Mary and Martha are sisters. They should dwell in the household in peace. So action and contemplation can dwell in your life in peace. Retain time and space to open ourselves to prayer, liturgy, and spiritual reading. Disposing yourself to more opportunities for this will put us into that climate that disposes us more and more to contemplation. By growing in our love of God, praying in humility, praying from the heart, realizing that we're not doing the heavy lifting, if we pray with humility, that God will come to us. We can cultivate more of a God's eye view of humanity and allow us to see everyone, even those co-workers, that person that drives you crazy on a day-to-day basis, as their brothers and sisters in Christ. So I'm going to give you kind of my cheater's version of reading one of Merton's books. And I've mentioned contemplative prayer, also known as the climate of monastic prayer, as what I based most of this on. It's already not a particularly long book, but for a lot of people I've mentioned, Merton, there's just a lot of depth there that takes me a long time. Each page I have to go back over and read again. So my kind of cheater's guide is to read chapters 1 through 5 and 11 through 19. Merton put together two disparate sources to make this book. And 1 through 5, 11 through 19 is one of those sources, and I think probably the best for most people, most readers coming to it. Chapters 6 to 10 deal a little bit more with monastic history. If you love monastic history, go right ahead and read that part. Those are good parts of the book as well. But if you want a little bit of a shorter read for the rest of this Lent, 1 to 5, 11 through 19, and I put that together in some of the quotes that I prepared for this presentation. But I'm going to wrap up right now and open up to some questions, but I'll leave you with the beginning lines to a poem by Thomas Merton. So in our lives, if we want to dispose ourselves for more time for silence and solitude and prayer, we can think of Merton's poem, Song If You Seek. And Merton starts that poem with, "If you seek a heavenly light, I, solitude, am your professor. So let silence, let solitude be your professor this Lent and lead you into a deeper awareness of God." Thank you very much. So hopefully I kept it light, and we had some dread, but we also had joy.